Hello.
Hey, Roz, it's Suzanne Del Banco calling.
Hi, Suzanne. How are you?
All right, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
It's great to talk to you. So I'm calling because I saw the study that you and your colleagues just published in Health Affairs. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, it was a big paper for us, and we're really excited for it to finally be published and available for everybody.
I'm sure. So, I really want to learn more from you about what you found when you and your colleagues did this systematic review of the evidence for payment reforms. Obviously, it's of great interest to me and to Catalyst for Payment Reform and probably our audience too. So I just wanted to let you know that we do have an audience listening in today. So if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, that would be great. And then I will proceed with some questions I have for you.
Sure, happy to. And thanks, Suzanne, for calling. It's so nice to hear your voice. Just so the audience knows, I was a previous employee at Catalyst for Payment Reform, so I always follow their work. And Suzanne and I are constantly in touch. So, but anyway, to give a little background about myself, so I'm Roz Murray. I'm a doctoral student at the University of Michigan in the School of Public Health. And my research interests are just broadly in the world of healthcare cost containment. So value-based payment, fits into that bucket of my research interests and agenda. So that's part of why we published this paper, why I participated on this paper. So I'm excited to talk to your audience, Suzanne. Thanks for calling.
And you guys remember the name Roz Murray because she's only just begun all the incredible things she's going to do in her career. She was such an integral part of CPR through many years and helped with really important projects. And this is a great continuation of that work, but in a more academic sense. So describe the study that you and your colleagues did, just at a high level.
Yeah, certainly. So we conducted a systematic literature review of all of the studies, the peer-reviewed studies that evaluate the effectiveness of commercial value-based payment models. So essentially, we just wanted to understand overall, how these models are doing. Are they improving healthcare quality? Are they reducing spending or overuse? And then to conduct this study, there are certain protocols that you have to abide by for it to be considered a systematic review. But I don't want to bore the audience with the details of that. So essentially what we did is we developed some search terms so that we could search through several databases of peer-reviewed studies and try to capture all of the relevant studies out there that met our criteria, essentially. So they were value-based payment models that were in the commercial sector specifically. They had, they were evaluated outcomes of quality, spending, or utilization. And so that was just kind of how we went about it, essentially. And because we were familiar with some of these studies already, if the search terms didn't pull up some of those studies that we were familiar with, we would modify the search terms so that we could, make sure we were capturing all of the, relevant studies from 2000 to 2020. So that was kind of the approach. And then one of my co-authors and I, we separately identified the relevant studies from the search terms. We reconciled any differences to, identify the ones that met all of our criteria. And then, eventually we landed on 41 peer-reviewed studies that evaluated the effect of value-based payment programs in the commercial sector on cost or spending, quality, and utilization. So it was a long process. It was, about a year long in order to do the whole thing. And then it took some time for the peer review process, but clearly it was a worthy effort for all of us, and we learned a lot.
Yeah, so I mean, during the years you were at CPR and still today, we've done two things simultaneously. We've pushed for more payment reform, and we've also said we need to have more evidence about what works and what doesn't. And it's just been remarkable to see the difference in investment that's made in, evaluating programs in the public sector, run by Medicare or Medicaid programs, and in the commercial market where, in our experience, at least, people are very hesitant to share results, or they just don't, you know, think about it academically and the need to sort of, you know, independently evaluate their programs so that, you know, the market can learn, you know, about what works, what doesn't, and try to, you know, sort of make corrections as we go along. So I'm just curious, you know, we had always felt there was such a paucity of studies, you know, does the number of studies that you found surprise you? Was it more than you expected, fewer than you expected?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, you know, so we pulled 41 studies, as I mentioned before, and there were more studies that we pulled to begin with, but they were more, I guess, descriptive in nature, that discussing how some of the payment models in the commercial sector were designed, or maybe they were qualitative, but we landed on 41, you know, empirical studies that captured one of these three outcomes we were interested in. And, you know, certainly this number feels pretty small, you know, given that value-based payment has been a major focus of the health policy community for the past decade, at least, if not more than that. And, you know, by contrast, I was looking at some systematic reviews in the Medicare, you know, in the public sector for Medicare, and there was a systematic review evaluating the bundled payment programs in Medicare, and there were 20 studies that were identified, and that's just for bundled payment programs. That,
right.
You know, it's not pay for performance and shared risk. It's, so that's a pretty sizable amount, I'd say, for just Medicare's bundled payment programs, right?
Yeah.
And then there was another systematic review examining Medicare's hospital value-based purchasing program, and there were 33 studies on that program alone.
Yeah.
So it's just to try to demonstrate that contrast that you were speaking to. You know, over the past couple decades, there really has been not nearly as many studies in the commercial sector as there have been in the public. And that, you know, may not surprise many people. It clearly doesn't surprise you. You know, as you noted, the big part of this is just accessibility of the data, and, you know, Medicare is a public payer, so they make this information available, but it's just much harder to get these data from commercial payers and evaluate these programs.
Yeah. So, you know, not that I have anything vested in this or anything, having spent the last 12 years of my life pushing payment reform, but what are the major findings of the study? You know, and are we at a place where we can, you know, conclusively say, hey, you know, value-based payment works, or it doesn't work, or it depends?
Sure. Well, I think essentially what we find is there isn't a lot of evidence that value-based payment is working in the commercial sector. Findings generally are very mixed. Just to run a few of the high-level stats behind you. So more of the studies that we identified in our review had positive results for quality than they did for spending or utilization. So it's kind of saying, well, maybe some of these programs might be improving quality, not doing as much for spending and utilization. It's pretty unclear. But when we actually looked at the rigor of the studies, so essentially to assess rigor, what we were thinking about is, you know, did the authors use methods that make us feel more confident that the findings are causal? So when we were assessing rigor, we actually found that the less rigorous studies were the ones that were more likely to find positive results. So, you know, some of these trends that we're seeing, they might, when we're accounting for rigor, we're less confident that there are positive findings, essentially. And then another thing that's important to note that in our findings is that most of the studies, except for a very, very small fraction, did not include the additional costs of the bonuses or the administrative fees in the analysis. So essentially they were just evaluating claims payments, the underlying fee for service spending, right? And so these studies that don't account for the bonus payments that are made to providers, they're actually underestimating spending changes or overstating any spending reductions that occurred. So, you know, it definitely makes us question, you know, whether value-based payment programs are working. I think it's just highlighting that there's a lot of mixed findings here. And that, you know, it's really unclear that they're accomplishing the original goals that they set out to.
Yeah, I remember when I think some of the earliest studies came out on the Medicare Shared Savings Program, that the cost to CMS of running the program outweighed the savings that they're able to generate. And, you know, it sounds like, you know, by not including the payments that are made, you know, either in shared savings arrangements, shared risk, or even pay for performance, you know, you're not getting the full story, just like with that, you know, the savings from the Medicare Shared Savings Programs at the very beginning, you know, it wasn't the full story. So, you know, how would you say these findings are similar or different from what's been found in evaluations of value-based payment programs in the public sector?
Yeah, so I think Medicare's programs they're shown to be somewhat more successful than what our papers found for the commercial sector. I wouldn't say significantly more. I think the bundled payment programs, you know, generally are showing more positive results or findings. However, you know, bundled payment only targets specific episodes, and so, you know, if it's affecting spending, it's not going to make a big dent in our overall healthcare spending. I think even some of the newer accountable care organization models in Medicare are trending in the right direction, particularly for providers that have been in the program for longer periods of time. You know, there's a learning curve maybe that needs to happen, or investment. I think that some of these papers were finding. But I think what's similar here is just that these programs, whether in the public sector or the private sector, they don't necessarily seem to be generating the big savings that we originally expected them to. And personally, I don't want to speak for my co-authors here, but I think it raises some concerns about whether continued investment in VBP is really a worthy effort.
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me so much of some of the arguments I made early in the days of pay for performance, when people declared after a couple of years that it just doesn't work. And then you looked at what percent, you know, bonus they were offering, and it was so wimpy that it was surprising to seek some kind of effect. So do you think there's a piece here too, where these programs are just not powerful enough, like the portion of funds at risk, or the strength of the potential upside, or whatnot, you know, is just not robust enough to change provider behavior? Or do you think there's just something fundamentally flawed about the idea of changing provider behavior through financial incentives?
Yeah, I think that's a important question, a good question, Suzanne. I think one of the limitations of our literature review, and part of this is just due to the timing of studies, but is that we weren't able to incorporate a lot of these new programs that are shifting even more towards, you know, financial risk, downsides for providers. So there's been, you know, a focus on this in more recent years, and there just haven't been, the studies maybe are currently being evaluated, or maybe they were released after we finished our review, but essentially, I think we just need more evidence to really understand whether those additional, you know, models that are moving further down the risk spectrum are able to be successful. I can't say that I know for sure, but it, you know, there's more evidence that needs to be produced for us to understand. Yeah. Certainly.
Yeah. So, you know, bottom line, we need more willingness on the part of the commercial sector to evaluate these programs and to share the results, so that we can have a better sense of, you know, what you were just saying, do we keep investing in this direction or not? So, you know, you've mentioned some implications for the payment reform movement, like big question mark. But are there any other implications that you want to share from the study of, you know, to the value-based payment or payment reform movement that you think it suggests?
Certainly. Yeah. And I won't touch on all of them, but I'll focus on a couple. So I think you'll like this one, Suzanne, but, you know, I think commercial payers, they have a really unique ability to use benefit and network design to make the enrollee incentives work in tandem with provider incentives under these arrangements. You know, when I was at CPR, and you and I published this suite of papers with the Urban Institute on the strengths and the weaknesses of these various you know, payment approaches and benefit and network design approaches, but also how they can work together to align both the incentives of the patient and the provider. And I'm, you know, that was something that we were looking for in these studies, but it wasn't something that we were able to glean. You know, it wasn't clear whether the commercial payers were using, were trying to align the incentives and of the patient and provider. So I think, you know, that could be an area where the commercial market might actually have more success. You know, at least they have the ability to use benefit and network design to their advantage, right? So
yeah,
that's one of the things that I think payers should be thinking about if they aren't already. And I think another challenge is just that there's little alignment between the public and private sector, even across the private sector. So it can get rather confusing and burdensome, honestly, for providers as they're navigating various payment programs and incentives. And perhaps there's a better way for alignment, but I'm not fully sure exactly what that looks like.
Yeah, right. It looks like herding cats.
Yes, right. Exactly. So then finally, I mean, I think, you know, one of the major things that I'm taking away from this, and some of this is work that you all are focused on as well, but, you know, maybe we're focused on the wrong thing. You know, if one of the major goals is to control healthcare spending, you know, maybe we're not targeting the right place or the right, you know, drivers. So is spending, it's a function of both prices and quantity, right? The care volume. And so in the public sector, care utilization largely drives spending because prices are fixed. But in the private sector, prices are negotiated between payers and providers. And I think there's been a large and continually growing body of evidence that shows that commercial prices have increased significantly over the past few decades. And they happen to be the primary driver of spending in the commercial market. And so maybe what this is suggesting is targeting overuse of healthcare services is maybe misguided, and we should be focusing our attention on, you know, efforts to control healthcare price growth. You know, so CPR has really been doing a lot of great work in this space. I really encourage, you know, your audience, your listeners, to take a look at some of your reports on this. And even, you know, I think you guys are also covering, you know, some of the work that's happening at the state level, but even some of the efforts that employers are getting involved in relation to controlling prices. So I definitely urge your listeners to pay attention to what you all are working on here.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, we started looking at prices when CPR got off the ground, because we were worried then that even, you know, significant changes to the methods we use to pay providers might not be able to stave off the cost increases that could result with price increases. Mm-hmm. We're worried about because of consolidation in the provider market. You know, there's lots of different reasons why prices go up. It could also be because of provider reputation, and, you know, many other factors, I'm sure hospital leaders would argue. Mm-hmm. You know, if we don't address price, I don't know if we can really call it payment reform anymore, because it is the unit price that has been driving, you know, cost growth more than any other factor as of late. And so, you know, I couldn't agree with your finding more. Maybe we have a melding of the minds from spending so much time together, but I really appreciate your perspective on this, especially after having done this thorough review.
Yeah, thank you, Suzanne. It's been really great to participate on this. I, you know, had some experience conducting these interviews myself when I was a CPR employee, so it's kind of fun to be on the other side of it.
Yeah, I love having you as a podcast guest for sure. Well, thank you so much for your time, Roz, and I can't wait to see the next study you produce.
Yeah, thank you, Suzanne. Take care.
Bye.